In the Moment is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 26th to 28th in Spearfish.
The news you use is only useful if it's true. From SDPB, today is Tuesday, August 26th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we welcome wealth advisor Rick Kaler. We'll talk about the fact-based foundations of our financial system. Or are those foundations fracturing? What happens when politics intervenes with your portfolio? We will explore issues of bias, and we will ask how to metabolize the stress of the markets. Then, Happy New Year to the teachers. Teacher Talk dives deep into the goals and resolutions we make in the classroom and try not to break at the launch of a new academic year. That's coming a bit later in the hour. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Decision is only as good as the information used to make it. Today, we're exploring how the news you consume impacts the financial decisions you make and how the quality of the data presented to economists impact their financial predictions. That's what we're talking about today with our financial guide, Rick Kaler. He is a wealth advisor in South Dakota and a pioneer of financial therapy. He also leads Kaler Financial Group in Rapid City. Here's our conversation. People have been following the news from Washington, particularly the August 1st firing of the Commission of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And that got a lot of political ink spilled on it, but also the reports that come out of this government agency are really important to you as a wealth advisor. Tell me a little bit about how you use that information, how your clients use that information that comes from places like the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
Yeah, the statistics are really important. Data is really important, especially to an economist and especially to people who follow the markets. And so this particular commissioner that was fired was ahead of the reporting on the jobs reports, how many new jobs were created in the month. And these are always an indication of how strong the economy is. They can give you clues that the economy maybe is sliding, going into recession, or coming out of recession. So there's so many of these, not just this particular indicator, that economists use to judge the health of the economy. And that can be a predictor of moves that some investment advisors may make with certain investments. So like with all data, it's pretty important the data is right.
Yeah.
You know, garbage in, garbage out is a famous saying, and it's foundational. And if the foundation has cracks or the foundation is not concrete but sand, this can negatively impact the house.
Right. So to be clear, the commissioner, was she fired because her data was sand-like? Was it a performance-based firing or mismanagement? Or what led to this? Because you would want to move somebody out who was not good at doing this very important job, yes?
Right, and I wish that was the case. I wish it was a case of mismanagement, poor data, et cetera. But unfortunately, and what makes it so stunning is that it wasn't about performance and it wasn't about the data. Now, the president would argue against that. But what happened is, They have a forecast every month of how many jobs that they think will be added. In this case, the forecast was 115,000. The added jobs were 73,000. Now, it is not unusual to miss a forecast. I mean, this is like the weather, right? Either on the upside or the downside. And I think what the other part of this is that they come out with what the jobs gains are in a month, and it is also an estimate, but it's not. It's as good a guess as they have until they have several months of data to correct it. And they're almost always corrected in some ways or another. And in this case, they reported that the May job gains were like 144,000. And when they got the data in, it was 19,000. And June's was supposed to be 147,000. It was adjusted down to 14,000. Now, this would suggest that the economy is much weaker than what they thought the data was showing. And a 90% downward adjustment is, it's rare, it's not common, but downward adjustments or even upward adjustments are not uncommon. And so it was this super disappointment showing that the economy actually is softening a lot that the president did not like.
He called it rigged.
He
So
said,
he believes it's rigged to make him look bad politically, and this was a
exactly.
political maneuver.
Right.
What do you think is happening here?
Well, I think there's a lot of psychology involved here and a lot of cognitive biases that, we've talked at length about. For example, one that comes to mind is something called confirmation bias. And that is, he was favoring data that confirmed the internal story and in internal and hopefully the external story that the economy was strong. And when the July reports contradicted that, he dismissed that as rigged rather than accept the evidence that things are not as good as what they appeared. And we see this all the time. You could have some anchoring bias in this, and that's where we anchor on the 144,000, and then when the data comes in that it was not that, we dismiss the new data and anchoring on the 144,000. So this is, there's some overconfidence bias involved here. Which is, I know more about this data than the hundreds of trained statisticians. I mean, this was not one person's number. This bureau has hundreds of people, and it has a very sound, integrous reputation. There was a lot involved in letting this person go, but it was basically that of, I don't like what the numbers are telling me, and I'm not going to accept them.
You also mentioned attribution bias, which is there has to be someone to take the fall. And in this case, it was the head of the bureau.
Right, and that was the the head of the bureau is a political appointee.
And a Biden appointee, it should be noted. So,
Correct.
what's the risk here? Because, I mean, I think we can all relate to our own biases, our own confirmation biases, or our own tendency to have, some self-serving tendencies, which is why you normally have a group of people around you who you can trust, who you can ask, like, what am I missing? What is the factual? What does the data say? When that becomes politicized, if that is what is happening here, what's the risk for the future of the financial markets and the trust that we have in them and the decisions that we make? Like, I don't want to overstate it and hit some panic button,
Right.
but we are watching this closely to see what happens next.
Well, if this was only the first and a standalone issue, maybe we would see it for what it is and not be so concerned. But the NASDAQ, for example, when this happened, dropped 2.25%. We've got to have good data. And the concern is that the administration wants to tell the public, the markets, the data that supports them, the data that supports their version of reality. And so, of course, the concern is they will put in new ways of doing things. They will improve the system in such a way that it will support the narrative that the economy is great. We're saying seeing the same thing with wanting to fire the Fed chairman, because in the administration's opinion, interest rates are too high. And wanting to politicize that branch, which has been a cornerstone in our markets of independence, that's been one of the attractive aspects of our economy, of our system, to investors globally, that we don't have a politicized central bank. So all of this together is causing a huge amount of concern, and something that I'm just running into as a financial planner, as someone who follows the economy almost on a daily basis, certainly on a weekly basis.
How would you advise a client who is really believes in the work that the president is currently doing for the country and is coming to you and saying, well, I trust this president. I believe what he's saying. But I also want to be a smart investor and handle my wealth well. Where would you help them kind of figure out how do I set the politics of this moment aside and look at the personal decisions I'm making with my portfolio?
Well, that's hard for that person. It's really hard to set the politics aside when the politics are telling you that the data is wrong, that long-held beliefs, I hate to even call them beliefs. I mean, I'll revert to the one that I think is the most obvious, and still it's not obvious, tariffs. When you're being told that a tariff is not a tax, when you're being told that tariffs are paid by the other countries, I mean, I don't know how, I just don't know how to be gentle or looking at both sides of the coin on something like this.
Sure.
It is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when your politics say, no, that's not true, and you get to make up your truths and make up your facts, and I'm not saying, you know, the old adage is you have, you can make a statistic for everything. And it is true. You can take data and off of that sound data, interpret it two different ways. So I'm not talking about that type of interpretation. I'm talking about facts. And when the facts are under assault, this is scary, because this is what you see in other state-run economies like China, like Russia, that... your listeners might be surprised if I say they're not socialist countries, but they're not capitalist countries either. They have what's called state capitalism. And that's what we see seeping into at a very fast rate into the United States and into our financial markets.
State capitalism,
NVIDIA, Intel, AMD, U.S. Steel, we're starting to see this. So you add all that up along with, well, we don't like the data coming out of this organization because it doesn't support our narrative. That's scary stuff.
You write in this column, the danger is that we stop making decisions based on truth. We make them based on whatever story feels comfortable. And while that may soothe us in the moment, it often leads to poor financial outcomes. And that word soothe just reminds me so much of the financial therapy aspect of this and the emotions of this, that it can feel comfortable. It's very uncomfortable or disruptive to have something that you believed sort of shift and realize that maybe you were wrong about something. Right. And it can be very soothing to just flip the story a little bit. Say more about that idea of creating a story that soothes us.
It's threatening, right? It's threatening to our narrative. And we've talked about this in cognitive biases before, that we can have a part of us where being wrong is like the worst thing that can happen to you. And there can just be a huge amount of internal shame about saying, I was wrong, or this data is challenging what I thought was true. And so this is what's under the confirmation bias, is this fear of failure, this fear of making a mistake. And you just said something that I hadn't thought about, but in internal family systems, you have parts of us that are called firefighters. And the firefighters are there to protect the exiles, the vulnerable, hurt, wounded parts of ourselves. And they will do anything to soothe the exile. And I hadn't thought about this in terms of I don't like this data. And the exiles are, oh my God, this means we're failing. This means the economy's failing. This means we're bad. This, whatever those are. So we will soothe them by just firing the messenger.
Yeah. We might have been wrong. Right? Like, we're not getting the outcome that we thought. If we push these levers, this would be the outcome. Oops, that's not the outcome. And one response would be, well, let's adjust the levers a little bit because that's not quite going in the direction we thought. And another response would be just call in the firefighters and put out the fire.
Whatever we have to do, scorched earth, if we have to fire the head of the data bureau, let's do it. And that's a classic firefighter move.
So again, you know, if you're an investor, I mean, I don't have advice for the president because that's not, you know, I haven't been invited to the White House to give my counsel. But one of the first things would be you're going to have to feel the discomfort of the data. You're going to have to feel you're going to have to sit for just a beat and say, oh, that feels awful to see those numbers. That is a terrible, awful feeling. And I'm going to have to go through it physically and breathe and then figure out, well, what am I going to do about the data? And that might be a nice step to take for starters.
Well, thank you for answering your own question for me.
You taught me how... And I've had my own uncomfortable moments in the past week, and that I have used your advice often of just like, okay, we'll just sit and this feels terrible, just sit and feel it, and it's gonna feel gross, right? You know, for days.
Yeah, and that is so important. Going back to the question of what do you do?
Yeah,
you know, when someone comes and it's the first thing is to just sit and feel that possibility that data could be right, or certainly it's in conflict, but just to hold that before acting on it, that is so important, very important in investing, very important in making a sound financial decision. Because I have the same brain everybody else does, and when I'm hit with information like that, I want to make a decision right now and let's get that anxiety gone.
Yeah.
So While I am certainly critical of the of what happened, of the firing of this person, I am not above doing the same thing in a less public situation. In fact, just recently, I told one of my coworkers, she said, you know, just sit with this a little bit, because what I'm telling you is true. I can go into action in a heartbeat. And later in the day, I emailed her back and I said, you know, I have sat with this now several thousand seconds. And now I'm ready to do this.
Yeah. Is there a point where you can tell you've kind of, for lack of a better word, metabolized it and are you ready to take action?
Yes.
Because like the feelings themselves aren't going to go, they're going to come in waves and you can't be crippled by it to the point where you don't do it. Oh, I'm still tearing up or I'm still getting mad about this thing. And I'm changing the subject a little bit and maybe broadening it a little bit. But is there a moment where you're like, okay, I've metabolized this a little bit and I can start making a plan?
It's, you know, technically it's when I'm not triggered anymore. And the brain has had a chance to dispose of the chemicals, the actual chemicals that trigger us. Now, I don't have a graph for that. I don't have a device or an app like, oh, okay, I'm clear now.
Yeah.
But for me, it's when I really don't have, I'll use the word energy. When I don't have energy around the decision. And sometimes that energy, that judgment, that anger, whatever that is that's kind of tipping me over, that can take minutes, hours, days, weeks to get on the objective side of that when I can step back and just look at it as is, almost like I'm looking at it in someone else.
Yeah.
When I can get to that place of being an observer of my own thoughts, feelings, and emotions. Now, that's a big lift. That's a big lift. So it's, and sometimes that can take years. I remember a psychologist that I co-authored some of my books with, he said, we were talking about what's the point of therapy? What's the point of doing group therapy and all this stuff? And he says, so you can tell your story. And I thought, what? What? Mm-hmm. No sense to me. So I could tell my story? And it took years for me to understand what he was saying. So I can not only tell it, that I can see it, that I can articulate it, that I can tell my story as if maybe I was reading it from a book, as an observer, and not as a still a wounded participant, which a therapist psychologist would call that unfinished business. Yeah. I have finished all the business and I now can tell you my story.
Yeah.
With objectivity.
And it's worth it. It's worth coming out on that other side. But it's hard in the financial planning world. I'm going to sit with this. Meanwhile, all your friends are making decisions and moving things and saying, I got this figured out. I was able to mitigate the risk. I was able to control this. There's a time for action for sure. I don't mean to imply that. So I guess this would be my real question is in the world of money. If I know that there's a time that might be a time for action, but yet I also know that I'm not the observer of this right now, who needs to be in around the table to help me be the observer that I really can't be at this moment if action does need to be taken in the next, 24, 48 hours or 2 week period of time, but I know I'm not going to be there.
And that has to be pre-selected. You cannot assemble the team in the middle of reaction, right?
Yeah.
And I just recently went through this in a transition that I've made, and I had people on my team And they had to talk me down off the ledge several times because I was triggered. And they would present the data to me. They would hear me and then refocus me on preset behaviors that we had talked about. So, for example, in investing, the preset behavior is we have spent a lot of time to put this portfolio together. We've spent a lot of time on the investments and the amount of each. We have determined that this is the best allocation come hell or high water. And then the predictable economic disaster hits. And everything inside says, sell, get out, while you've got something left. And if you have those people in place, your financial advisor, maybe a financial therapist, whoever those people are that helped with this, that's when bringing a person back to center, bringing you back to, we established this, we prepared for this ahead of time, can be so helpful in not going off the rails at that time. But that system needs to be in place before the crisis hits.
Well said. All right. Any final thoughts as we all consider the uncertainty of these times in the financial industry?
Yeah, it is uncertain. It's important. I've written about this in columns. I think I have 4 columns out there. It is important, the media diet that you consume, because this can keep you, like when you said all your friends are doing this, selling out, buying, whatever it is, that's hard to resist. And if all your friends are watching one extreme section of news, this is difficult because that's herd mentality, right? We are herd people. So it's so important to have a balanced consumption of media, because consuming too far to the left, too far to the right can really hurt your finances. And I have written quite a bit on what those media outlets are.
Yeah.
And that's the most helpful. And again, this is almost impossible for somebody who's either on one side or the other to accept and hear this, because everything else is bad. Everything else is jaded. Everything else is biased. In the end of the day, that's one of my big touchstones as a advisor, is to try and look at the reasons by, the intentions with everything, and hearing the conflicting opinions, so that I can come to something that feels reasonable and in the best interest of me or my client.
That's Rick Kaler, wealth advisor and financial therapist at Kaler Financial Group in Rapid City. You can find his articles on the topic and more at his blog. We'll have links up to that on our website at sdpb.org/news. Coming up, it's not quite time for New Year's resolutions, but it is time for school New Year's resolutions. Teacher Talk checks in from the first day of school, and we'll talk about goals for a new year. You're on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Our Teacher Talk educators are wishing all the teachers, administrators, staff, and students a Happy New Year. For many, the start of school is the real new year, full of new classes, new teachers, new clothes, new supplies, maybe even a new school. Gina Benz is a high school teacher at Roosevelt in Sioux Falls. She's also an adjunct professor at the University of Sioux Falls and the University of South Dakota. She has been teaching for more than 25 years. Jackie Wilbur is a faculty member and director of the Center of Student and Professional Services at the University of South Dakota's School of Education. Gina, welcome back. Happy first day of school.
It was my first day of school, the day we're recording.
Yes.
And I am exhausted. You really find out that the summer got you out of shape when you're a teacher. Yeah. And I'm not talking about normal out of shape that all of humanity experiences. It's a teaching out of shape. Mm,
there's an endurance to coming back in, or a conditioning.
There's an endurance to maintaining a certain amount of energy with the teaching all day long, and also constantly scanning the room to see how things are working and what the puzzle pieces are going to be.
That focus.
It's hard. I love teaching.
Yeah.
I love teaching, but it is not for the weak.
Yeah. You're 26?
You're 26. Yes. Yes. But I think I'll build my stamina. Yeah. I always do.
Yeah.
Your voice sounds good. That was always my thing. By the end of the day, I would kind of have a groggy voice at the start, but you sound like you kept your voice. Ready
I guess I kept my voice. We'll go with that.
So how many different classes do you have throughout the day?
So where I teach, high school teachers have 5 classes they teach in a day. Now,
okay.
God bless the small town schools. Those teachers usually teach 6 classes in a day. Absolutely. And so 5 50-minute periods of teaching, plus usually teachers will have a little study hall or a homeroom that they also are managing. But the first day of school is so full of hope.
Mm.
It's a really beautiful vibe, if you will, or atmosphere. Everyone comes in with hope because it's a fresh start. And that's the most important thing for all of us to realize. This is everyone's fresh start.
Yeah, yeah.
We can start from scratch again.
Yeah. I love how you come back from the first day of high school saying vibe. The vibe in there.
Oh, believe me.
What else is the lingo?
I have to speak their language, right? I was doing a poem today, and I wanted to talk about the tone of the poem, but believe me, I'm not using the word tone right away.
Yeah.
We talked about the vibe of the poem and how it shifted.
Jackie, are the students back at USD yet? What's
Monday.
Happening on campus?
Yeah. Tomorrow is move-in day, so
we're recording this on Thursday.
Yes. So, Friday will be move-in day, and then Monday the 25th is the first day of class. So it's always a very busy day and weekend because you've got parents dropping students off and there's futons and bedding and all kinds of fun stuff. So
chaos.
Yeah, and in a very organized and fun way. But yes, it feels, I mean, the town almost doubles when the students arrive back on campus. So it really shifts the tone.
The tone, the vibe.
The Vermilion vibe right now.
Exactly.
That's the vibe in Vermilion. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and is it different every year, Jackie? In a college town, or is it the same?
It's the same and it's different. You know, I went here as a student and I feel all kinds of nostalgia and like things haven't changed at all. And then it's incredibly different. Brand new buildings have popped up since I went to school here. Even in my own building here in Dalzell School of Education, we got brand new bathrooms upstairs, which was very exciting. We looked at those today. New classroom upgrades. There's just all kinds of changes that occur throughout campus.
Gina, what are your classes like? Can you tell from the first day of what this class is going to be? Because every class is kind of different.
I ended my day really excited about my classes and my students. They all came in and I didn't see a phone. I didn't see a phone. And they maintained eye contact and they engaged with me in everything we did.
Yeah.
Of course, I kept things moving and we'd be up and we'd be down and all the things. But I also have a ton of hope for the school year.
Yeah. So if people are just tuning in for the first time, Ms. Benz is on a journey with the smartphones.
I am.
And this week's podcast is about New Year's resolutions. So it's Happy New Year.
So my social media post, personal one, will be Happy New Year. And I'll, of course, have the post, you know, of my kids on their first day, me on my first day.
Mm-hmm.
And I love those. I don't know how many of you out there also love the social media posts of kids on their first day. And I'll say Happy New Year. And today in Teacher Pathway, I said, Happy New Year. Here's your teacher notebook I give you.
Mm.
We're going to start by putting our New Year's resolutions in this teacher notebook.
Nice.
And because to me, this is the real new year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Jackie, do you make teacher New Year's resolutions?
I feel like Gina is much more deliberate in her New Year's resolutions.
The rest of us are just winging it.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. But yes, I feel certainly the sentiment of the new year. I feel the freshness that it brings. There is the physical, like, okay, I have new courses to teach. We've got new systems in place where there's a lot of newness. And so that with it brings a sense of a new beginning.
Yeah. All right. Your new resolution number one.
So I have two New Year's resolutions, and resolution number one has to do with smartphones. Mm-hmm. And I decided, as I should, I'm all in. What my administration tells me, I am all for it, no matter what. And so my resolution is not just that we'll follow the rules, but that there's wisdom in these rules. Mm-hmm. And we will embrace the wisdom of these rules. And that's that we need to take moments when we don't have notifications going off. We need to have moments when we can focus, when we can slow down, and enjoy each other and yeah. enjoy the learning. Yeah. So I'm going to be very, very, my resolution is to be very, very diligent and positive, always with a positive tone, not a punitive tone, a positive tone, that this space is where we get to focus on each other and focus on learning.
Yeah. So your original plan was cell phones are going to be in the backpacks before we start.
I know.
And then you learned your school's policy. What's the policy?
The policy for my school, mm-hmm. this I think this isn't, the overall policy is no phones except for before and after school and during lunch.
Okay.
Schools have freedom in my district to decide exactly how that's implemented. Mm-hmm. And so at my school, everybody has phone holders or phone pockets. Let me tell you what that is. So if you think of a shoe holder that you can like hang over your closet door,
okay.
it looks a lot like that. It has numbers on it. You can just search it up on a website, you know, phone holders, you'll see classroom phone holders, and students put their phone into their designated pocket. And a lot of teachers will then take attendance that way.
Oh.
Yeah. Now, of course, there are students who don't have phones.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so that's a conversation you have and you adjust. Mm-hmm. There will always be exceptions that you adjust for. So I do have the phone holder in my classroom, and students are assigned their pocket.
It's like a cubby for your mm-hmm. phone.
That's another word people use, cubby. When I think of cubby, though, I think of something more solid. The phone sure. holder is made out of canvas.
Okay. So where's yours?
Mine is just a little bit from the front door, so it's at the front of the room. Okay. I gave some thought to that. Some like to have them in the back of the room for various reasons. But I thought the front of the room, because then people can still always have an eye on their phone and know it's there and know it's sure. safe.
Yeah.
That was my thinking.
Where's your personal phone?
In my backpack.
Okay. So so the teacher's phone doesn't come out.
And go in the cubby?
Yeah, I didn't know.
Oh. I'm going to think on that. That yeah. might also send a good message that mm-hmm. we're all in this together. However, what kind of a good prank is it to take the teacher's phone or something like that, right, when she's not looking?
She's got to consider all the angles, Jackie.
I've got some thinking to do.
She's got to consider mm-hmm. all yeah. the angles.
Now, of course, kids are not going to all abide by this. Yeah. I will have moments where it's not how it should be.
Yeah.
And in the blog, in the post, I said that I'm going to be a warm demander. That's my intention. That's my resolution. So
remind us what that is. Yeah.
Yes. And so you can go back to our episode where we talked about that in more detail. But very quickly, it means that I will try to be discreet in redirecting my students or mm-hmm. In having them follow the expectation. I'm going to be discreet in it because if you just call someone out in the middle of class, there's an audience all of a sudden. And you might be asking for a battle because someone might have to prove.
You might be
themselves.
Asking for a performance. Mm-hmm. If there's an audience, you're asking for a performance.
Well, that was perfect. That was perfect. So I'll discreetly remind them of the expectation. And I will also believe that the word no is a complete sentence mm-hmm. for me, right? And if they choose to say no, too, then I'll follow through on what my school has said are the appropriate yeah. consequences.
And there's a theme here, Jackie, that I find encouraging in education, which is, you know, you hear Gina saying, I had this one thought in my mind of what I was going to do, and then I saw the school policy, and I was like, oh, well, we're going to do this, and I'm all in. Mm-hmm. Being all in with what your administration says is something worth considering right now. And that they're your backup.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones who are setting these policies. So it's not just that you're being told what to do as a teacher. It's that you don't have to, you don't have to make all those rules.
Right.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about that, Jackie. And like, you know, when you go to a school district and you're looking to place, you know, your students, and they're looking for their first home. Mm-hmm. It matters who the administration is and whether they feel like they're on the same page with that administration.
100%. I mean, that's my background is in educational leadership, and I've never served in a principal or superintendent role, but I do have an administrative role at the University of South Dakota in higher education. And so it's a different perspective that I frequently reflect on, that when you are the teacher, you follow what's happening at from the administration, right? But you are also part of those decisions. You get to voice your thoughts. There's meetings and surveys and conversations, and you can go talk to people about how you're feeling about the policies that are in place and give feedback on what's working and what's not. Mm-hmm. But from an administrative perspective, you do sometimes have to make decisions that are like, this is what we need to do, and we all need to get kind of on the same page in order for this to be effective. And cell phone policies are certainly one of those things. If people aren't doing what Gina's doing, if you're not all in, it's very difficult to implement. So I always think folks like Gina are incredibly important to leadership because she is leading in her role. Other people respect and admire her and want to be doing what she's doing because she's an excellent example of what it means to be a teacher. And so if she's in, it's much easier for the administration to have buy-in from the other folks.
Yeah.
And so to more directly answer your question, when we're sending students out, we really encourage the importance of being all in. And they do have, I spent most of my summer working on our processes for how students select where they're going to be going out into do their student teaching and their teacher residency, and they have a fair amount of say about where they would like to go. So we encourage them to do their research about where they think they might be a good fit.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I love that. All right, there's another resolution here too, and you alluded to it a few minutes ago, Gina, and that is empty moments. Tell us about
that.
Well,
if you're not going to have your phone handy, mm-hmm. you're going to have moments when you normally would reach for your phone. This is for anybody in this world. When you are sitting in the waiting room of your doctor's office, most people are on their phones, no matter what age they are.
Yeah.
And so what if you don't have your phone? What do you do with the empty moment? And guess what? They don't have magazines in waiting rooms anymore.
Right.
So I realized I have to be very deliberate and intentional about just saying, if you finish the assignment early, mm-hmm. here are the things you could do.
Mm. You're teaching that.
You have to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because that's what greases the wheels to make everything run smoothly and learning to happen. But there's certain social, emotional things you have to teach so that the learning can happen for everybody. Another example would be sometimes I need to restart my computer.
Yeah.
Everything froze up, whatever. That's an empty moment when a lot of people would quick check their phones and then maybe get sucked in, maybe not. And so when the computer needs to be restarted, I need to explicitly say, here are the things you can do right now. And it might just be, ask your neighbor how their day is going.
Yeah, I love that.
This actually is trending amongst college-age students. I've seen it in social media, where they will do things intentionally without social media, without their phone, the trend I've seen it most often is being on an airplane, where they will not intentionally have their phone, not watch the in-flight movie, not read a book, and just do the term that I've been seeing on social media, I'm not sure how I feel about it, is doing these things raw. So you just raw be on an airplane.
Yeah, they do. That's what it is.
What does that mean exactly?
The vulnerability, the exposure of the phone.
See, kids, they'll reclaim this stuff ways that you don't
it's
if you let them.
It's pretty smart, actually, but smart. Again, I don't know how I feel about it.
But I've seen pictures where people are just staring ahead the whole flight.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it's true.
And it seems weird, but it won't always seem weird if more right. people
well,
do it.
What did we do before?
Well, and it sort of feels like an ice bucket challenge or something where they're really trying to do something very True. Difficult
True.
and painful.
No, I've True. Seen the like sit and do nothing competitions. I know I've yeah. seen that like, you know, where they get together and just sit and do nothing for as long as they can without falling asleep. So
mm-hmm. I've never seen that, a competition. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. But I like what Gina's saying here, Jackie, about like telling, also teaching, like this is something you could do.
Right.
You could talk to your neighbor. You could stare at a piece of paper. You could think about what you had for, I don't know what all you're saying.
Look out the window.
You could look out the window. You could, you know, do these things. We're reminding people it's about less than don't look at your phone, and some more than do something. And it's this thing, and that's why that thing is good. Mm-hmm. Looking out the window is awfully nice.
Right. Well, yeah. there is creativity that spawns from mm-hmm. moments of boredom. There are ideas that become discovered because you let yourself take a pause. The yeah. idea that there needs to be constant productivity, and I feel like I say this on Teacher Talk very often, but that it is in the space that learning happens. Mm. You can't just mm. make students continuously feed, you can't just feed them information all day long. They won't digest anything. They need time to think about what you have said.
Yeah, yeah, brain mm. research shows that every 12 to 20 minutes, there has to be some sort of break for processing.
Mm.
And processing might just be staring out the window and letting your brain absorb it.
Yeah. No, we process so much information from sleeping, right? Mm. There's just, mm-hmm. you don't need to do something to process. In fact, doing something is not processing time.
Yeah.
It's doing something.
Ooh. Say it again.
Doing something is not processing time. You actually need to not be doing something to give yourself the space to process.
I like that.
I like that too.
I listened to a podcast this weekend, and it was about, it was on hidden brain. And
mm-hmm, that's a good one.
There was a brain scientist who was talking about your brain's equilibrium being like a seesaw. It's kind of like, you know, you might be set at sort of being kind of a sad person. You might be set at being sort of a happy person, but we all have our little set point. And then when there's a pleasure pain balance. And it was just talking about that sort of low key anxiety that you have, and then you reach for your phone. And then the pleasure side of the seesaw goes down. But then there's these little, like, think of them like brain gremlins that sort of jump on the other side of the seesaw to bring things back into equilibrium. Mm. And how if you do the thing too much, look at your phone, use a substance, you know, whatever it is that you're doing that's maybe a little maladaptive, that there become a lot of gremlins mm-hmm. who are jumping on the other side of the seesaw to even things out. And it was super, and I think about that, like figuring out what to do when you want to look at your phone
yeah.
instead of doing it. There could be a moment of discomfort that you have to learn how to sit with. And depending on whether you had like a full addiction to your phone or whether you're just dealing with a little overconsumption of phone time, mm-hmm. sitting in that moment and trying to figure out how to deal with it is part of the success.
Mm-hmm. It takes practice, because mm-hmm. my personal goal, not professional goal, not new professional New Year's resolution, but just a personal goal I've had is that when I am in a waiting room, dentist, whatever it is, to just sit and do nothing. And that's just a little challenge I've had for myself. And it was hard at first, but it gets easier with practice.
Yeah. That's Gina Benz and Jackie Wilbur. There is more to this conversation. You just listen to the full Teacher Talk segment online at SDPB's Teacher Talk podcast. Find it at sdpb.org or on your favorite podcast platform. And that's our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ellen Kester and Ari Youngman. I'm your host, Lori Walsh. From all of us here at SDPB, thank you for listening.